Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. This is Stephanie McFeeters, the deputy editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to informing Mainers through investigative and explanatory journalism and empowering them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, the Monitor's reporters and editors talk about the stories we are working on, many of which you have likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. Today, I'm joined by our editor, Kate Koff, and our community news fellow, Emily Hedegaard, to discuss their recent series on Maine's maternity care crisis. Kate, Emily, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So to start, I think we need to address a big development that just made the news last week after you finished your series, which is that MDI Hospital announced it will be closing its birthing unit as of July 1st, which, you know, as we've seen from your reporting, makes it the 10th hospital in the state to announce such a closure in the past decade. The hospital president said the choice to close the unit followed a steep decline in births, and she said it was a devastating decision. The Maine State Nurses Association called it an abject failure, and were very critical of the decision. According to the hospital president, the hospital delivered 32 babies last year, which was about a 46% decline from the previous year. And 9 babies have been delivered so far this year. According to them, they said, you know, a decade ago, they were averaging about 100 births annually. So they said this decline was, you know, the reason for the closure. And the hospital said that there are about 30 patients who are currently pregnant and will be affected by the closure. And the hospital president said that, you know, only half of them were expected to give birth at the hospital, apparently. But it certainly, you know, will be tough on the community. And it, you know, fits into this pattern that you all found in your reporting of, you know, these closures happening in rural areas. Kate, you live in Bar Harbor, and I understand you were at a community meeting over the weekend where this closure was discussed. Can you tell us what that was like?
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Stephanie. And, you know, I think I should start with some news that some folks around me know, but not everyone is aware of, is that I am actually pregnant, and I was due to give birth at MDI Hospital this fall to my second daughter. So I learned about this. I learned about the news of this closure actually in a press release on Thursday. And then shortly thereafter, you know, the hospital called me to tell me a little bit more about the transition. But I was stunned. So, you know, as a journalist, you never want to make yourself the story. You never want to be in the center of the story. And I think, over the course of reporting on this, I knew that MDI Hospital had a low birth volume. And speaking to the hospital president, we knew that the unit was potentially at risk, like many of the units in rural Maine are. But I will say that the news of the closure still really stunned me. And it was sort of far more emotional than I expected it to be. My daughter was born at that hospital. My dad was born at that hospital. And it's just really a center of the community. So I did go to the meeting over the weekend, and there are going to be two community meetings held on this topic, but the first one was held by the Maine State Nurses Association. And it was a chance for people to just come together and learn a little bit more about the closure, and hear from the nurses on sort of some of their perspective. There were maybe 80 to 100 people at the meeting, and lots of little babies running around, a number of pregnant people as well, and several state representatives and a state senator. And I think I can say that the overwhelming sentiment at the meeting was really just sadness. I think There was a lot of frustration as well, and there was a lot of anger. But I think people were overwhelmingly just sad at the loss of this real community space. And there were a number of people who told, the story of having their own children there, or being born there, and just the wonderful care that they'd received at the hospital. It was a very emotional meeting. There were a lot of tears. Yeah, it was really, for somebody who's been sort of covering this as objectively as possible over the past couple of years now, certainly when you interview people who are pregnant and who have lost access to their maternity care, it's very emotional. Emily and I have talked to a number of mothers who had have to drive very long distances, sometimes, hours round trip, and have complicated pregnancies where they're having to go to the hospital fairly often. And I really felt the difficulty that they were dealing with, but it was different to sort of experience it myself, and it was different to be in that space as a member of the community and as a journalist.
Yeah, that is really hard. And, I think that, in some ways it's that's sort of what it is to be a reporter in your community. Like, we're reporting on things and we're, being as objective and fair and transparent as we can be, obviously, but we're also living in these places and we're experiencing, the changes that we're reporting on ourselves. And that's just the nature of, the challenge and the beauty, I think, of local news. But in this particular case, it's something that, I can imagine was quite tough, and it's something that, you and Emily have spent months reporting on. And it's like you said, it's one thing to sort of understand it abstractly and to, even to hear all these emotional stories, but to go through it yourself is, yeah, I can imagine that that was really emotional. So we appreciate you, sort of being able to share that with us, from both perspectives. So I just wanted to, take a little step back because obviously you were paying attention to this issue before, the news broke out of MDI. What prompted you to start reporting on maternity care in Maine and to sort of, conceive of this series with Emily?
Yeah, I mean, a little, some of it was personal. I think the first story that I wrote on this was in 2023, which would have been about 8 months after I had my first child. And you become like you said, Stephanie, we are people in the community, and you become aware of things in a different way once they, are really happening to you. So I became very aware as a person who giving birth in a rural place. I sort of got integrated into this community of mothers in Down East Maine, and I started hearing stories from people who were, just having really difficult time getting to their appointments in far flung places. And then, I heard about an initiative at a hospital in Washington County, which is now Down East Community Hospital in Machias, which has the only remaining maternity unit in Washington County. And they were really struggling with costs, and particularly staffing costs, and after the pandemic. And they decided to sort of implement a really interesting arrangement, which was that they decided to have some nurses from the medical surgical department at the hospital flex, sort of cross over and cross train into the obstet in the obst in obstetrics, so that they could help out in the obstetrics department, which was a very unusual arrangement, but it was sort of the only way that they saw to be able to keep this unit, which is a real lifeline for people in the eastern part of the state, open and operating. So I went, and I went to up right at the beginning when they were starting this arrangement. I went up to Washington County to just observe a little bit and speak with some of the nurses who were part of this. And over the course of reporting that story, I was in touch with all sorts of experts around the state, and I just began to realize the scope of this problem was, it was just huge, and it sort of it seemed like there was no chance it was going to abate anytime soon, given the sort of financial pressures on hospitals and the declining birth rates all over the state. So I knew this was something we needed to keep paying attention to. And when Emily came on board as our community news fellow in the fall, she expressed an interest in this issue. And I thought, well, this is perfect. You know, we've this is a this is something that we really need two reporters on. I mean, it's a really big topic. And so I you know, Emily and I have done more than 20 interviews of you know, people around the state just for this series. And so that's a lot of time spent talking to people. So yeah, we thought that this really deserved a deeper look. We initially could we can talk more about this, but we conceived of it initially as a single story, and then it was clear that we had a lot more than that on our hands.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, so that's what I wanted to get at next. I mean, you eventually decided to structure this series in, you know, in three pieces, sort of looking at the closures that we talked about, and then also the role of midwives and then potential solutions. And Emily, I wanted to start, you know, with the closures. We said at the top that this MDI hospital closure makes it the 10th in the past decade. What did you learn from these experts you spoke to about what's causing these closures? What's behind them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's really a slew of things that are causing these closures. One thing that we heard from experts was that staff retention and short staffing has been really hitting hard, especially in rural areas of the state. Research shows that a physician in training is most likely going to practice within 100 miles of wherever it was that they did that training. And a lot of experts we spoke with said there weren't a lot of opportunities for training in those rural communities. So it's hard to get physicians in training who are established in different parts of the state into our rural communities. It's also expensive to run these departments, especially where we're seeing declining birth rates statewide and nationally. A lot of hospital administrators that we spoke with said that it just didn't make sense to be funneling so much money into these departments when we're only giving birth to so few babies a year. And then on top of that, keeping staff trained has become really difficult with the declining birth rates. And so for the safety of patients, to make sure that they're going to locations where staff are trained to nth degree is really important. And so all of those things combined have really hit these rural communities particularly hard.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you know, I wanted to talk a little bit more about that because that's something that you really focused on in your reporting, which is that, you know, these closures have hit rural communities particularly hard. Can you tell us what you heard about that, Emily?
Yeah, so it's hit these rural communities in a lot of different ways. In a more logistical level, now patients have to drive upwards of 2 or 3 hours to the nearest hospital for their pre and postnatals, or even during labor to give birth. But more so, it's hit and it's struck an emotional chord with a lot of people in these communities because the hospital, as one person we spoke to put it, is the heart and soul of the community. And so, yes, it's affected these communities in the way that patients have to give birth, but it's also affected a lot of people's sense of community and community pride.
We had I think we've got one statistic in the first story that you know, on average, rural Mainers whose closest hospital doesn't have a birthing unit are now driving 45 minutes one way to the nearest birthing hospital. And we talked to a couple of people who had complicated pregnancies, and you know, as anyone who's been pregnant knows, you know, often in your third trimester, if you have a complicated pregnancy, or even if you don't, you are at the hospital once a week, sometimes twice a week for care, which means that you're really losing, you know, depending on how far you have to go, half a day of work. That's really very difficult for many people. There's money for gas to get over there. There's the cost of childcare if you have other children who need to be taken care of while you are going to these appointments. Depending on how reliable your transportation is, you might need somebody to drive you. We're not talking about communities. Public transportation is lacking all over Maine, but at least in sort of the parts of southern Maine, you might have a chance of taking a bus to the hospital or finding some other way to get there. But it's really very, very difficult in some of these places for people to get to these appointments consistently. And if an appointment gets rescheduled, everything gets upended, and you have to re sort of find more child, find childcare again, or change your job and change your work schedule. So it's really just, as Emily mentioned, just very logistically complicated for a lot of people.
You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, we're discussing the closure of birthing units throughout Maine and what that means for communities going forward. So I wanted to talk about the second piece that you all did in your series now, which focuses more on the role of midwives. And to start, can you just tell us, what does a midwife do, and sort of tell us about the different certifications they have? Because I know it's a little bit more complicated than people might think.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kate and I have kind of joked that there's this alphabet soup of certifications and licensing to become a midwife, and it varies state by state. But in Maine, we have nurses who are also midwives, and they're called nurse midwives. And then we have midwives who are not nurses. They're usually called independent midwives. And independent midwives will most commonly practice at a freestanding birth center or attend home births. And so our research found that there's been an increase in both uses of midwives, both nationally and statewide. And so we use nurse midwives in our hospitals when people are giving birth. Some administrators we spoke with actually said that they feel that nurse midwives should take on a larger role to help with the staffing shortages, which I'm sure we'll dive into a little bit more when we look at solutions. And then independent midwives we spoke with also really advocated for more use of independent midwives and for their role within our state.
And I'll just add briefly, we should say sort of at the top, the vast majority of births in Maine are still occurring in hospitals. So we've got about 97% of births occur in a hospital setting in Maine. But there has, as Emily mentioned, been a pretty dramatic increase in the number of home births in the state. The jump, I think, was around 41% between 2018 and 2023, as our reporting showed. But we're still only talking about fewer than 350 births in 2023 were home births. So it's still a fairly small percentage, but it is definitely increasing.
Got it. No, that's good context to have. So most births are still happening in hospitals, but there is an increase, even if it's within a pretty small group of people who are, choosing to give birth at home or, at these independent birthing centers. Emily, can you tell us a little bit, you guys report in the story that, some of these patients are choosing to do this because they want to avoid those long drives that we've talked about, or because they worry that, some of their wishes might not be respected in a hospital setting. Can you tell us, what you heard from those patients?
Yeah, so some patients that we spoke with had planned inductions. That way they could, like you said, avoid some of those long drives. And it allowed them to schedule things on their own terms, which was really important to them. One thing that we did notice, though, is that a lot of patients we spoke with who are giving birth out of hospital weren't actually avoiding those long drives. A lot of them were still giving birth at birthing centers that were upwards of 2 hours away from where they lived. And so they were choosing to drive those multiple hours during labor just so that they didn't have to give birth in a hospital. And I'm going to let Kate jump in from here for 1 second.
Yeah, well, so one of the people that we profile in the story, in our second story, is a woman named Caitlin. And as Emily mentioned, she actually chose to drive the 2 hours to a birth center in Bangor for both of her pregnancies, even though she actually does live near a hospital with an obstetric unit. She began her prenatal care at that hospital, but told us that she was, the phrase she used was turned off during an appointment in her second trimester because the staff told her that they would have to end her appointment early to deliver a baby down the hall, which you can imagine might be something that happened and happens in a hospital where they have a pretty small staff. And one of the other things that we heard from people who had given birth during the pandemic, when some of those restrictions were in place in hospitals, was that they really didn't they wanted to have several people in the room, which wasn't allowed. I gave birth to my daughter during the pandemic. We were very restricted. Nobody could come and go except for me and my husband. We weren't allowed to leave the hospital to, he couldn't go out and get me a milkshake or anything like that. So there were a lot of people who chose to give birth in a birth center or at home because they didn't want to adhere to those restrictions. Caitlin told us that she drove these couple of hours just so that she could have a little bit more of what she perceived as more freedom around her birth. She gave birth at a birth center, a freestanding birth center staffed by independent professional midwives in Bangor. That we actually talk a little bit about that particular birth center in the story. It's called Holly Number 7. And it saw an 82% increase in births between 2018 and 2023. It's still, again, a small number of births. There were 40 overall in 2023. But it was the biggest percentage increase of any hospital or birthing center in the state over the past 5 years, which really just gives you a sense of how many people are looking at this as a potential option.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And one of the things you found, in addition to, the sort of growing popularity of some of these independent birthing centers, is that s hospitals are also incorporating more nurse midwives into their birthing practices. Is that right? Can you tell us a little bit about what that looks like?
I'll start with this and then I'll let Emily jump in as she can. The hospitals are absolutely incorporating more nurse midwives into their practices, both in Maine and around the country. We talked to a number of hospital administrators who said they were doing that at the request of patients who were really wanted sort of somebody with midwifery training to attend their birth. As Emily mentioned, there is this alphabet soup, and the sort of broad distinction that we draw in the story is between nurse midwives and independent professional midwives. Nurse midwives are, maybe it's explanatory from the name, but they are nurses with a midwifery degree. So I think the statistic we cite in the story is that nationwide, in the decade between 2012 and 2022, the proportion of births attended by a certified nurse midwife went from 8% to 11%, which isn't a huge jump, but we've seen a lot of this incorporation in Maine. I think every hospital that we spoke to had incorporated nurse midwives into their practice and was planning to do more of that. So it's absolutely something that we're seeing. And we'll talk a little bit more about this later, I'm sure, but the United States is somewhat unique in its reliance on obstetricians as sort of the primary point of care for pregnant people. Many countries around the world rely very heavily on midwives and nurse midwives for sort of the bulk of care, the bulk of both pre and postnatal care. So we're sort of moving in that direction a little bit.
Got it. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And in speaking to these midwives, both the nurse midwives working in the hospital setting and some of these independent midwives as well, what did they have to say about how the sort of landscape is changing in Maine? And are there things that they would like to see, working differently? Yeah, what was their sort of perspective on all of the closures and how things are trending in the state? Emily, can you take this one?
I can. So a lot of the midwives that we spoke with really advocated for being used more within hospitals and outside of hospitals. So certified nurse midwives that we spoke with, like Kate said, there's been an increased use of certified nurse midwives within our hospitals, and they really advocated for that. They think that's wonderful and want to see more of that. And then the independent midwives we spoke with spoke really highly of their relationships with hospitals, but did say that they wanted to have stronger relationships with the hospitals, and just hoped that they could continue building the wonderful relationships that they already have. Now that being said, there really isn't the infrastructure in place for a lot of what these midwives were currently advocating for. So that is something that would need to change in order for that to happen. And I'm happy to go into that a little bit if you'd like. So that would look like a couple of different things. So, for example, other countries like countries in Europe tend to really heavily incorporate independent midwives into their systems, but they also have things like universal health care and more streamlined and generalized training for their midwives, which, like we mentioned earlier, is not really the case currently in the United States. So those are a couple things, and I'm sure Kate can jump in here with a few more things that we would need to change, but the overall consensus was that the infrastructure really isn't in place, but midwives really advocated for it.
Like Emily said, the midwifery-led model of care is very common across the world, and I think that was absolutely something that we heard from midwives in Maine was that they would, and to be frank, some obstetricians as well, was that they thought that the midwifery-led model of care made a lot of sense, but that we would need to change things pretty significantly in the US to make that feasible. Certainly, streamlining training, which now is really variable across the states, is something that would need to happen. The single-payer healthcare aspect is really huge. Midwifery care, independent midwifery care, is not, for the most part, reimbursed by most insurance companies or Medicaid. I think there are 18 states and Washington, D.C. re reimburse non-nurse midwives under Medicaid. Nurse midwives are covered in all jurisdictions, but the non-nurse midwives are only covered in a handful of states. MaineCare, which is Maine's Medicaid program, covers nurse midwives but does not reimburse for services by midwives without a nursing degree. So, that makes it it's very expensive. I think if you wanted to, Emily can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was more than $7,000 out of pocket to give birth at Holly number seven. So that, and none of that would be covered by insurance. So that would be something someone would have to pay out of pocket. I will say, while the hospitals that we spoke to are not planning to incorporate independent midwives at this point into their care, and they're really focused more on the nurse midwifery aspect, there is a statewide push to increase access to doulas. So doulas are non-clinical providers who are basically can provide educational support, physical support, emotional support to families, both, while in the pre and postpartum periods. And there is a bill in the legislature right now that would require MaineCare to cover doula services. So that's sort of moving through the legislature, although it does kind of face an uphill battle because it's a very tough budgeting environment, as I'm sure everyone knows. But the state also does have there's a grant that the Maine Department of Health and Human Services has that would require the state to cover doula services within the first 3 years of the grant. So that's sort of that's kind of where the movement is at right now. That's, it's again not midwives, it's doulas, but it's that adjacent kind of care.
You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. Today, I'm joined by the Monitor's editor, Kate Koff, and Community News Fellow, Emily Hedegaard, to discuss Maine's maternity care crisis. So we have, we've sort of started talking about this already in terms of what the midwives would like to see and sort of what that infrastructure would need to be. But in the last story in the series, you all really focused on potential solutions. And so I want to, spend sort of a lot of time talking about that because I think, it's easy to get caught up in the crisis and to sort of talk about the impact of all those closures. And obviously it's really important to do, the reporting on that. But we also, I'm sure listeners are curious, like, what does this mean going forward and how can we change the situation basically? And I know, that's something that you all were really looking at with this last story, and you talked to a bunch of experts and, heard a lot of interesting ideas. So, one of the ones that I know you heard and you touched on in the piece, is that there are a lot of providers in rural communities who could do this care, and that they don't necessarily need to be trained OBGYNs. And like Kate said, elsewhere there is a little bit more of a flexible approach. What did you hear from people in this vein?
Yeah,
Ellen? Yeah,
so
great.
a lot of the people that we spoke with, hospital administrators that we spoke with, said that we need to make it easier for physicians in training to train and practice in rural areas. So, like I mentioned earlier, a physician in training is most likely going to practice within 100 miles of wherever it was that they did that training. So, allowing them and getting them into rural areas of our community is going to be really important. Looking at staff that we already have, hospital administrators also said that we need to make better use of them within our hospitals and within our community, like you mentioned. So that could mean a handful of different things. That could mean cross-training staff across departments, sort of like what the hospital in Washington County did with their med-surg nurses. It could also mean sharing staff that are within the same hospital system. So having staff, at one hospital that's merged with another hospital and moving them around in that way. It could also mean allowing staff that aren't doctors but who are highly trained to step in and take first call and work with nurse midwives to perform births and then only bringing in physicians for more complicated cases or C-sections.
Yeah, and I know I mentioned at the top this hospital in Washington County, and that transition, but I'll talk a little bit more about that because it is, I think, something that we are going to see quite a bit more of. As I mentioned, they were facing this, I think, $1.5 million gap between the projected costs and their nursing staff charges, and they were facing, a declining number of births, and really looking at the possibility of closing the only remaining maternity unit in all of Washington County. And so they did this cross training. And just to give you a sense of what that actually looked like, one of the unique things about obstetrical care is that it's the only specialty in which you have two patients. You have the mom and you have the baby. So it really does require pretty specialized knowledge in many cases. So these medical surgical nurses, they were trained in a lot of newborn care. They were trained in resuscitating newborns. They were also, I think, what this allowed them to do was really shift their staffing. So, as Emily mentioned, taking call is a finding enough people to take call is a really big deal in rural areas. One of the things that we have seen consistently and heard consistently from hospital administrators is that it's extremely difficult to hire an obstetrician if that obstetrician has to be on call all the time. So we see a lot of burnout of these providers in rural areas where they are, just can't have any other life, basically. They are constantly on call. It's exhausting. They can't be with their own families. And that makes it really difficult to retain them in these rural areas. So one of the things that this sort of flex arrangement in Washington County helped with was it allowed them to have to go down to just a single dedicated obstetric nurse on shift rather than two. So not only did that sort of help with their costs for traveling providers, but it helped with people having to take first call. So they also have now they now have a just somebody to kind of fill in staffing gaps. They have an anesthesiologist, a pediatrician, a nursing supervisor, a respiratory therapist, which that's a huge amount of that's a lot of different skills of very highly trained people that you need to staff a unit like this, which is what makes it so complicated. So pulling in people from other areas of the hospital is definitely something we're going to see more of. And I think as we reported on after sort of that initial story we wrote about the arrangement, it wasn't a seamless transition. There were some nurses who reportedly left the hospital because they were uncomfortable working with those highly specialized obstetric cases. That's what we heard from the nurses union. But when we checked back in with them in while we were reporting this series, the hospital said that the flex arrangement was still in place, that it had really helped close the staffing gap, and that even though their BRRs were down, that they felt confident that this was what was helping them keep the unit open. And I will, I'll also note, as Emily mentioned, she mentioned the fact that you don't necessarily have to have an obstetrician to perform a C-section. So in order to have obstetrical care at a hospital, you have to have somebody who can perform a C-section, available at all times. Babies are not adhering to anybody's schedule. So you need to have somebody who can do that. And that means either having an obstetrician or having a surgeon who is trained to perform C-sections. That was the case actually for many years, according to people we spoke to at MDI Hospital, that they actually worked, they had a general surgeon who was trained in performing C-sections. That person was able to alleviate the call burden and able to take those cases. So that really helped quite a bit. It meant that they were able to, not to have have as many obstetricians on staff as they might have had. So that's certainly something that we heard from, training surgeons to be able to perform C-sections in rural areas is definitely a solution that we heard from hospital administrators that they are looking at. That, one of the other things that we heard, again, to sort of help alleviate the call burden is to allow specially trained nurses to take first call, as Emily mentioned. So you only bring in a physician if it becomes complicated or, if a case becomes complicated or require a C-section. We also heard some interesting solutions about sharing personnel across a hospital system. Maine has two major hospital systems now, Maine Health and Northern Light Health. And so I actually heard at the forum I went to this weekend that some of the nurses at MDI Hospital had gone up and trained at some of the higher, the hospitals north of us where where they have a greater number of berths just to kind of keep their skill set up. So that was something we heard, having bringing people who are working in a low volume hospital to train at a higher volume hospital periodically so they can make sure that they are keeping their skills up is an option. We also heard in sort of the other realm of cross training about family medicine physicians. So there are a lot more family medicine physicians in Maine than there are obstetricians. They outnumber them about 10 to 1. So there was a paper that we read published in 2024 by what's called the Maine Rural Graduate Medical Education Collaborative. And they suggested that they said, Maine graduates about four obstetric residents every year, all out of Maine Medical Center in Portland. But we graduate about 35 family family medicine residents every year out of programs in Portland, Lewiston, Augusta, and Bangor. So their suggestion was that Maine look into establishing a family medicine obstetrics fellowship, which would train family medicine residents in obstetrics. 28 states already have a program like that, including in Massachusetts. And that, would be a way. And, as Emily has said that physicians are much more likely to practice, stay around where they've done their training. And so we already have them, these family medicine physicians training in more rural areas of the state. Sort of cross training them in obstetrics would definitely be a way to maybe keep them in the community.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, and that's I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. I mean, it makes sense that just from sort of a just a common sense perspective, that if you train somewhere as a resident, you put that's where you sort of learn to do this work. You're gonna be more invested in that community and potentially stay there. Is that what you heard from experts, Emily, when you talked to them about sort of the role that these residency programs play in the pipeline?
Yeah, it is what we heard. And like Kate said, there's really only one residency program for OBGYNs in Maine. And there are more students who want to go into obstetrics than there are places to train them in our state. And so experts that we spoke with sort of mentioned this residency bottleneck. And so we have all of these students who want to go into obstetrics, and there just isn't a place to train them. And then the few who do land in the residency program in Maine typically stay within that area. And so, like Kate mentioned, there have been discussions about opening other sorts of training places or finding staff who aren't necessarily in obstetrics, but have the skill set that they would need to perform births and bringing them into those locations.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I know, we already talked quite a bit about the role of midwives and sort of the infrastructure there. And that was definitely something you all, spent a lot of time on in the solutions piece. But another thing that came up is training EMS staff. Could one of you sort of talk about, about that piece of it and sort of the role that they play in these rural communities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as we see these closures happening, EMS providers are being called upon not only to, potentially perform births in on the side of the road or in people's homes, but they're also being called upon to transport more newborn patients and mothers who might be in distress. And that's something that if you have an obstetric unit in your community, you don't necessarily need. So they are really being called upon to just do things that they haven't before. So we have seen that the rural EMS providers, who I should also note, as many people might realize, are sort of having a crisis of their own, and are really struggling across the state to keep their services up and to sustain themselves financially. So they're having their own crisis while they are being called upon to provide these extra services, or not extra services, but services maybe beyond the scope of what they traditionally did. And yeah, I mean they're absolutely, the EMS providers that we spoke to are increasing training. There was a bulletin put out by Maine EMS just last week, I believe, on the hospital OB unit closures and sort of providing a little bit of guidance for services, for EMS services around the state who are going to need to deal with these cases. It's kind of a small thing, but one obstetrician I spoke to talked about a device that they have that they now have in ambulances, where it's just basically a better sort of restraint system for the newborn that allows the newborn and the parent to ride together in the ambulance, which was apparently not always the case. It used to be that they would take the newborn, but they couldn't have both patients in the ambulance, which is, I think, as you can imagine, probably pretty distressing if your baby is in crisis and you can't be in the ambulance. So they now are incorporating this system in order to be able to transport both of those patients together. They're just sort of small things like that that we are seeing them have to do as they are having to deal with these patients that they didn't have to see before.
Yeah, well, this all sort of, I don't know, it just makes me think that it takes a village not only to raise a baby, but to deliver a baby. And it's about the hospital, but it's also about, the midwives and the doulas and the EMS folks coming out and just a lot of different community members involved in this process. And when one piece sort of falls apart, then the other pieces have to step up in different ways. And I think that's sort of the push and pull that we're seeing right now in these rural communities. And then another thing that obviously is at the center of a lot of this is money. And I know that's something that you all talk to folks a little bit about in that story is that the main care reimbursement rates just are not matching what the hospitals need to provide these services, and that they're really hoping for some sort of financial reforms. And obviously, in the current environment that we're in, with sort of the main care, the broader kind of main care Medicaid crisis, it's a tough time to think about those reforms. But I'm curious, what people said when you talked to them.
A lot of hospital administrators that we spoke with, like you mentioned, just said that the reimbursement rate was not where it needed to be to sustain having a birthing unit in their hospital. And that's the general overview of it. And I'll let Kate jump in here with the more in-depth version, but yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's worth saying again something I think we've mentioned, but maybe haven't really laid out that, OB is unique in many ways in that the costs are fixed. You have to have a certain level of care, and it has to be available at all times because babies don't care who's on staff that day. So the costs are high, they're fixed. Obstetricians have the highest malpractice rates in the country, which really impacts the cost that hospitals pay to keep them on staff. And so you have this unit with very high fixed costs that, I mean, certainly can vary depending on where you are. So if you have a whole variety of specialists on staff, the cost of the unit is going to be higher, but there's just a baseline that you can't get around. And so once you start having low birth volumes, that sort of cost per baby, as it was put to us by someone, is really high. And the reimbursement rates are really, from what we heard from everyone we spoke to, just really do not approach the cost of actually covering this care. So there's a lot of numbers in this part of the story, and I don't want to, go too far into them because it's easy to get lost in numbers when you're on the radio. But I will just say that so on average, private insurance in Maine reimburses for little over $14,000 for a vaginal delivery. MaineCare reimburses providers $4,600 for a vaginal birth. So that's a $10,000 difference per birth for an uncomplicated birth. We're not talking about C-sections or anything beyond that. For an uncomplicated birth. So that's a huge difference in cost, right? You multiply $10,000 times however many number of babies you have, and you can see where the shortfall comes. And, I mean, as you mentioned, Stephanie, we're in a very difficult budgeting environment. The MaineCare program is facing $118 million budget shortfall at the state level. The state, we have since seen them pass this sort of basically temporary budget, and that is going to get us through till next year. But we saw some of the strain on providers. We saw the state actually temporarily holding payments to some participating providers in Maine Care starting in mid-March. We saw Maine Health announce earlier this month that they were going to be laying off about 100 people, in part because of this reimbursement issue and just the financial strain. So I think realistically, everybody that we spoke to said that major reforms, and this is, leaving aside everything that's happening at the federal level, where we've also seen major proposed cuts, and we are seeing, at the federal level to Medicaid and other programs. So that's not even sort of touching that aspect of it. I think realistically, an increase in reimbursement rates just doesn't seem feasible from everybody that we spoke to. So I think that the state does have a grant. It's a 10-year grant for $17 million that was announced earlier this year. And under that grant, there is a little bit of money in there to sort of support birthing units that are at immediate risk of closure, but that doesn't kick in for several years. So it's really, doesn't help the hospitals that have announced closures this year. But they do also, under that grant, have to implement a value-based, quote unquote, value-based payment model by 2028. So under that model, payments for maternity care would be tied in part to the implementation of certain like best practices that address things like mental health and hypertension and sepsis in pregnant people. So, I think we will see some maybe restructuring of the payments, but whether or not we're going to see any significant change in the reimbursement rates, just seems very unlikely in the current environment.
Yeah, it does seem unlikely. Both as you said, because of sort of the state, the state budget situation this year, but also, everything that's happening at the federal level. Well, I just want to zoom out a little bit and, think about this. You both spent a lot of time talking to folks, and you heard some really emotional stories, and you also, talked to a lot of experts about, both the problem but also some potential solutions. What, and Emily, maybe we can start with you. What surprised you most during the course of this reporting process? What were you really struck by?
Sure. Well, after reflecting on this full series, although I don't think it necessarily surprised me, what impacted me the most was just learning how important these hospitals were to the people that we spoke with and to the communities. I think it's really easy to look at this story on a surface level and sort of have the perception of, it's just a hospital or it's just a medical facility, but it's a lot more than that to these people. And like we mentioned earlier, one patient we spoke with referred to it as the heart and soul of the community. I remember one interview where the woman I was speaking with mentioned that her husband had been born in this hospital, and she had been born in this hospital, and her parents had been born in the hospital, and now her child couldn't be. And just how heavy that was on her shoulders, how much she had looked forward to having her child there and then not being able to. And so I think the emotional impact that this had on people, that's what's really stuck with me. This is more than just units in a hospital closing. This is people losing a sense of community pride, health, and security.
Yeah, it's really true. I was surprised at sort of the residency bottleneck. I was surprised that there were more people who want to become obstetricians than there are spots for residency programs. But honestly, one of the things that really surprised me over the course of reporting on this was some the reading that we did on the decline in birth rates. And so, birth rates have been, well, I'll just, back up. I mean, I think for sort of decades, kind of like the late beginning in the late 60s, there was a lot of concern about overpopulation and, how are we going to feed this world where the population curve is just and it's just on an exponential growth trajectory. And what has really become clear in the last couple of decades is that birth rates have declined dramatically, and for around the world, almost universally, and for a variety of reasons. I mean, having birth, I mean, giving birth and having children is, maybe one of the most personal decisions a person can make. So you can't, like, there's no one reason that that birth rates are falling. But we've seen this dramatic reduction in teen pregnancies. We've seen just sort of wider availability of birth control. More, people have more control over their family planning than they did in decades past. And I, in the United States, I mean, fertility rates have dropped more than 20% in the past 3 decades, and we are now at a place where we're having about 1.6 births per woman of reproductive age. The 0.6 is a as somebody I read this article that put it as the statistical laundering of great personal tragedy, which I think is the best way to put that. But so anyway, we're basically sort of below replacement rate of the population. People have really complicated feelings about that. I mean, some people see sort of the strain on the Earth's resources, and I understandably think like falling birth rates are fine. That's not a problem. And some people see it as a crisis. I think that sort of regardless of how you feel about it, regardless of how you feel about it, in that sense, it poses sort of huge structural problems for the system that we have set up, because our system has relied on a, us and on an expectation of a certain replacement population, and on having sort of, a generation of young people to take care of our older people and do certain jobs. And so if we don't have that, I think it just is going to require a pretty dramatic rethinking of many of these systems, and many of them in rural areas. And so I think that was what really kind of hit home for me, is that we're going to need to figure out new ways of doing all kinds of things, because we are just not going to have enough people, particularly in these rural places, to sustain the services in the way that we have had them before. So that was really, those numbers were really shocking to me.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Well, we're about at time, so I just want to thank you both for this really, really interesting conversation here. And I know we're planning to continue covering this issue, and so I just want to wrap up by putting a call out to listeners. If you live in Maine and are affected by the birthing unit closures, or you have a relevant pregnancy story to share, we'd love to hear it. Emily will, really be following this, so you can reach out to her at EmilyH@themainmonitor.org. It's Emily, the letter H, at themainmonitor.org. You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU-FM and the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. To read the series and to learn more about our reporting on Maine's maternity care crisis, you can visit themainmonitor.org. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archive shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Stephanie McPheeters, and this is Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill.